Well, here's a quote for you. Few international problems in the post-war period have proved as difficult for Australia as the development of a friendly and effective policy towards Indonesia. Now, would you believe that was 50 years ago? It was Sir Alan Watt, an esteemed Australian diplomat, and he was speaking after Indonesia's annexation of West Papua in 1962, obviously a very sore point in relations between Canberra and Jakarta, a relationship that's been tested quite a bit in the years since. Remember the Indonesian invasion of East Timor in 1975?
And those are the sounds being broadcast to East Timor at this very moment from the Indonesian state-controlled station at Kapung, just across the border in Indonesian Timor. The radio has been asking East Timorese people to lay down their arms and stop fighting. Direct reports from Dili are scanty, and almost all of them coming via the wireless networks in Darwin. Dili is now occupied by Indonesia, according to reports, and so...
Or our liberation of East Timor in 1999.
Emotions over East Timor are boiling over in Jakarta. An anti-Australia, anti-peacekeeping protest. Keep out of East Timor or die is the message.
Or the diplomatic crisis over the West Papua refugees in 2006.
Applause to President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono as he keeps his country's Papuan asylum dispute with Australia alive during a speech to a meeting of national planners in Jakarta yesterday. He said that Indonesia cannot be harassed or played with, and said that the relationship with Australia was under review until it is fair. He acknowledged...
Or 2013, when Indonesia found out that our spooks tried to bug SBY's phone a few years earlier.
If Australia feels that there are ways of obtaining information other than the official one, then one wonders where we are in terms of cooperation. I think they should be able to say, henceforth, they are not going to do it anymore. Enough is enough.
So clearly, Canberra-Jakarta rifts are hardly rare. And really, they're hardly surprising either. After all, we're so different. You know, language, culture, religion, history, ethnicity, population size, and in legal and social systems. I don't think any two neighbours on Earth are so comprehensively different. So why should we be surprised about this latest discord, and how can we fix it? I have an impressive panel to discuss the matter. Richard Woolcott is a distinguished diplomat, having served as Australia's ambassador to Indonesia in the mid to late 1970s and the United Nations in the 1980s. And Professor Andrew McIntyre is Vice President of RMIT University in Melbourne. He was the founder of the Australia-Indonesia Governance Research Partnership. Gentlemen, welcome to RN's Between the Lines.
Thanks, Tom.
Pleasure to be with you.
Dick, are we right to call on Jakarta to change its position on the death penalty and give clemency to these Australian drug smugglers on death row?
Well, like a majority of Australians, I have always opposed the death penalty. But, you know, each independent country determines its own laws, and Indonesia, like Singapore and Malaysia and I think the Philippines, do have the death penalty for drug smuggling, and a number of other countries too, in the Middle East, like Saudi Arabia, for example. But I think we really need to be consistent, and while I think a lot of prominent people, including our parliament, have made a real effort to persuade Jokowi to seek clemency, I think the two things, we need to avoid gesture politics and we need to be consistent. Now, we haven't been consistent on the death penalty because the Howard government, John Howard in particular, approved the execution of Saddam Hussein and also called for the execution of the Bali bombers in 2001. So consistency is one thing, and I think we also need to listen more and lecture less, and you've got to get a balance into this.
Well, Andrew, Paul Keating has long recognised that Indonesia is a proud nation, and I think it's fair to say all of us agree that it's been very sensitive to foreign interference in their internal affairs. It goes back to a colonisation. But he even recently came out and called on Jakarta to, quote, heed the appeals for clemency in respect of the two Australians in its charge. Does that surprise you that Keating would come out like this, given his close relationship with Indonesians over the years?
No, I don't think it's unreasonable that Mr. Keating would come out in that way. I think it is right for the Australian government to stand up for values that Australia cares about, and it's right for an Australian government, when the public is feeling something strongly, to push hard on it. It's also right for the Australian government to have due regard for due processes in Indonesia, and I think that's gradually working its way through.
Well, on that note, Andrew, when these executions do take place, presuming that they do in the next few weeks, should we follow in the footsteps of Brazil and the Netherlands and withdraw our ambassador in protest?
We will need to follow through in some way. I'm not sure that withdrawing the ambassador is the best way to follow through. Of course, when one withdraws ambassadors, one always eventually needs to send them back. We will need to have some sort of follow-through that is demonstrated publicly and demonstrated privately. But the challenge for Australia, as it is for Indonesia, will be to manage the fallout from these executions, assuming they do go ahead.
Well, Dick, Dan Flitton, The Age's foreign editor, recently reminded us that Indonesia itself pulled its ambassador from Australia in the past decade. Remember in 2006, after the, I think it was 42 West Papuans were granted refugee protection. And of course, late 2013, after the Edward Snowden leaks. Yet we never make a habit of withdrawing our ambassador from other nations, do we?
No, and I don't entirely agree with Andrew on this. I think it would be a mistake to withdraw our ambassador. We've never done this. We didn't even do it during a confrontation when our forces were in combat with Indonesian forces in Sabah and Sarawak in 1962. I think if you've got a good culturally sensitive ambassador in the field, you need them more in times of crisis, and I don't think withdrawing them achieves anything. Well, and I take Andrew's point, but I do think we need to be careful here. There's a lot of background to this related to sovereignty. The Indonesians have been very disappointed with Australian activities in the past, both the Labor government and the Liberal government, the suspension of the live cattle trade, the announcement by Obama in our parliament of the marine deployment.
Late 2011.
Actually, 2 days before Indonesia was hosting a major conference, and they were very concerned about that. They had the spy story. So I think while this is a case which has attracted enormous attention, we really can't afford to allow a case like this or even some other issues to really determine the nature of our foreign policy.
Well, Dick, if we don't withdraw our ambassador, what can we do? The Prime Minister has come dangerously close to making Australian aid a bargaining chip. Here he is.
Let's not forget that a few years ago, when Indonesia was struck by the Indian Ocean tsunami, Australia sent $1 billion worth of assistance. We sent a significant contingent of our armed forces to help in Indonesia with humanitarian relief, and Australians lost their lives in that campaign to help Indonesia. And I would say to the Indonesian people and the Indonesian government, we in Australia are always there to help you, and we hope that you might reciprocate in this way at this time.
Now, Julie Bishop has also said that she hopes the Indonesians don't underestimate Australian public opinion, and she's warned that some people might be moved to boycott Indonesia, particularly the tourist magnet Bali. Dick Woolcott, have we dug ourselves in a hole here?
I think we have. I think it was unwise to link our assistance during the tsunami to this particular issue. On the other hand, I don't think Tony Abbott intended to do that. And also the issue about doing something like suspending tourism to Bali. I read some poll recently where 89% of the people who are planning to go to Bali in the next few months, 89% said they would not change their plans. So you run up against this issue of balance. The Indonesians think a lot of this is gesture politics based largely on the domestic political situation here. Now, it's also based, of course, on a disgust for the death penalty, which we've abolished. And would like other countries in the region to abolish. But it still exists in Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, and Australians have been executed in those countries.
This is Between the Lines on RN. I'm Tom Switzer, and I'm discussing Indonesia with Richard Woolcott and Andrew McIntyre. Andrew, what are the alternatives to withdrawing an ambassador? How can, I mean, given that our leaders, both sides of politics, by the way, have dug ourselves in a hole, what do we do? What's the alternative to withdrawing ambassador?
Look, there are dangers for both countries here. On the one hand, both countries need to stand up for values that matter to them and processes that matter to them. And on the other hand, we're both going to have to manage the fallout from this. There is now significant mobilisation of public opinion on both sides. Well, we've been talking a moment ago about the possibility of Australian tourism falling off to Bali. To take an example from the other side, Australians would notice it if students from Indonesia stopped coming in the same numbers. So the challenge is going to be for governments on both sides to find a way to manage the fallout from this. I think there will need to be some public follow-on from the Australian government. As I said, I'm not sure that withdrawing the ambassador is the best way to do it. It may be that there's some other form of public declaration that the Prime Minister can make, and then things follow up privately after that.
How would you both respond to this criticism made by critics on the left? I'm thinking of people like Scott Birchall from Deakin, John Birmingham from Brisbane, and indeed many talkback callers on radio in Sydney especially. They would argue, after all the ingratiation and appeasement, all the overlooking of Suharto's crimes and brutality, all the batik shirts, how come we still have so little influence in Jakarta? That's what they would argue. How would you respond first, Dick Woolcott?
Well, you know, I'm very, very aware of that. I've lived through some of it. I mean, there have been these... I think one of the tragedies is that here we are, two immediate neighbours, very close to each other, and every now and then a terrible thing happens, like the death of the five journalists in Balibo or the invasion of East Timor, and this feeds into that fear of Indonesia, which is really... I think unnecessary. We're very, very fortunate that Indonesia, which is a country of 250 million people and 83% Islamic, is a very moderate form of Islam, and it's tremendously important to us. I mean, our relations with the great and major powers, the United States, China, and Japan, Russia and India, they're all important to us. But Indonesia, which is so close and so large and so complex and to some extent ignorant about Australia, or maybe not as ignorant as we might think, it's growing economically rapidly. It offers a challenge and opportunities. It's a very complex relationship. It will be set back if these people are executed, but hopefully the larger, wider regional and global picture will be kept in place, because Indonesia is going to have a bigger economy than Australia in about 5 to 10 years' time.
Andrew?
Tom, I'd make two comments on that. On the one hand, it is true. There are real limits to Australian influence in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. It is not a symmetrical relationship.
That's right.
The other hand, this is a really poor choice of a litmus test.
Mm.
Because what it is asking is for the Indonesian president to treat people from another country differently before the law than treating citizens of his own country. And that is a very difficult thing to ask.
Mm. One last thing for you both. Tony Abbott, in the lead-up to the last federal election, said, "We need more Jakarta and less Geneva in our foreign policy." Question, is Indonesia now at the centre of our foreign policy outlook, or is it simply in the too-hard basket? Quickly, Dick Woolcott.
Well, I think it should be at the centre. It probably is in the too-hard basket for the time being, but I think to the extent that Abbott meant that the focus was going to be on Southeast Asia rather than the Middle East and Europe, that was a good and sensible comment. But so far, it's largely been rhetoric and needs to be reinforced by activity. If we really take this being the so-called century of Asia to be true.
Andrew McIntyre?
It will be at the centre of our strategic thinking, but there is going to be a slowdown in what can happen at the operational level now for a while.
Mm. Richard Woolcott, Andrew McIntyre, I wish we could talk more. Thanks so much for being with us today on Between the Lines.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Andrew.
Author Paul Bogard worries that we're losing our sense of darkness. In Europe and North America, the amount of light in the night sky continues to increase by around 6% a year. But new forms of lighting technology, LEDs in particular, promise a more sophisticated and controlled approach to urban illumination. Lighting that becomes a distinctive architectural feature, not just an urban utility. That's Future Tense, and you can download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.